Hello, Annie.
Hello, Annie.
Hi, Con.
How are you doing this Tuesday, sweltering Tuesday?
Yeah, this absolutely sweltering Tuesday. I am doing well. We are here in, I believe it's either week 9 or week 10 of debt ceiling mania.
they've been warning us since January, so it's longer than that.
Yeah, it's been absolutely ages. But it seems like we have 2 weeks until Treasury stops being able to send out checks. So we're getting pretty close to the deadline here, and it appears that there's maybe some movement going on in Congress today.
Have you had a chance to look at this Gang of Six, five pages, that they sent out?
Yeah, so I looked at it, and I was at something this morning where Senator Chris Coons was there, and he seemed very hopeful about it. You know, they passed this out to 49 senators. They think that this might actually work. I'm a little bit more skeptical that this plan will be able to pass through both houses. But it doesn't have a lot of detail in it. It has a fair number of tax increases and a fair number of spending.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because I just did a post myself with some very back of the envelope calculations. And because, the document itself describes itself as a $1.5 trillion net tax cut.
Right.
So just off the top, I think that lets a lot of people scratching, how can a plan that, the Democrats said would have to raise at least $1 trillion end up being a $1.5 trillion net tax cut?
Right. So, and this gets to an issue that has been, sort of woven through this entire debate, which is, the difference between tax rates and tax revenues, right? So a lot of what this is doing, and it's based somewhat on the Deficit Commission, the Simpson-Bowles plan, is that it's cutting tax loopholes. And so that, I think, is actually a priority of both parties, but for a long time it's been thought that, in order to cut those loopholes, you would also have to cut rates. Of course, if you're not doing that, then, you got into this argument, are you doing enough? And I think that you're going to reach a lot of Republican intransigence on it, even though there's obviously three members of the Gang of Six who are Republicans.
Right, but I think there's actually a lot of rate increase, at least over the current rates going on now, maybe not current law.
Sure.
But, according to my back-of-the-hand calculations, I believe, if they're talking about a $1.5 trillion tax cut, that means, they're definitely working off of a baseline that assumed that the Bush tax cuts would be extended, that the AMT would not be eliminated. So
right.
So they limit the AMT and they allow the Bush tax cuts to, or would have allowed the Bush tax cuts to expire.
Right.
So if you use that as a baseline, that would have been a $4.8 trillion tax hike, according to the CBO.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're talking about a $1.5 trillion next tax cut, that means that in reality, this Gang of Six plan is a more than a $3 trillion tax hike over the current rates.
Right. True. So your reaction to it is essentially you don't think that this will fly, or
I think it's going to be tough to get a $3 trillion tax hike through the Senate, let alone the House.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem like and I haven't delved into the details of it. And the truth is that I don't think that anybody has really delved into the details of it, because it is not terribly detailed at all.
Like I said, the calculation I just did is definitely not in the plan. All I use is their 1.5 number and just – work logic backwards on how they possibly could have come up with it.
Right. I mean, at this point, what's your preferred, what would you like to see them pass? if they were going to pass something, if Con Carroll were king for a day, what would you want them to move forward on here? Because we have 49 plans. It's not like people are not coming up with creative ways to attach things to lifting the debt ceiling. But yeah, what's your preferred thing here?
Oh, well, I told Bill Scherer my preferred plan way back in January when everyone was just beginning to talk debt limit. I was hoping that I was never hoping of big spending cuts. I didn't think there was a lot to cut out of 2012, let alone fantasy cuts in the future. I was hoping for something kind of more simple, something along the lines of block granting Medicaid, just some type of fundamental title reform that wouldn't necessitate spending cuts,
right,
but would allow for Republicans to get a real policy victory,
right,
and go home. So that was my dream scenario. That, of course, is nowhere near going to happen. now I'm just, you know, which of these plans that do I like the least or hate the least?
Yeah, and I mean they are dizzying, and at least, you know, when Mitch McConnell brought out his sort of surprise plan to have Congress essentially raise the ceiling and to kick some power over to the executive, which at that point on the politics I've been like, this is at this point like 11th dimensional chess. I have no idea what's going on. Like, the politics on this have become just extraordinarily complicated. But policy-wise, you know, for a while I thought that the Obama White House was conceding way too much. I didn't understand why it was that they were pushing for a bigger deal as opposed to a smaller deal. Now I think that that's a bit more evident, that what they want to do is they want to sculpt a plan so that the cuts are backloaded into the second, you know, the second half of the 10 years and the budget window. And so that they, you know, keep as much government spending as close to right now as possible, because the, you know, they feel that the recession sort of lingers, even if it isn't technically a recession and unemployment is so high. So I understand the White House's desire to have a really big plan to get this over with once and then to move on to other issues. Of all the plans on the table, you know, I wish I knew more about the Gang of Six plan. It doesn't seem like the worst one to me. And I'm certainly very strongly against balanced budget amendment, which I don't think could pass anyway, but nevertheless, I think that some of the more ambitious policy ideas that have gotten tacked onto this are probably unnecessary. And funny enough, you know, in that sense, I think that I agree with you that I prefer to see something a little bit simpler than what we've been talking about. But it is, it's just, I mean, it's anything, any policy option that has been discussed in the last 2 years has somehow been brought up in the course of these discussions.
Well, what really scares me is that we just, you know, haven't heard a lot about what's going to be in this McConnell backup plan. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. You have Reid, well, you had the McConnell plan, which is basically just a clean, you know, debt hike, mm-hmm. which is actually, for a conservative, you know, not that bad an outcome. I mean, I think this whole, you know, make them vote for three times. If you vote for the McConnell plan, you're not voting to raise the debt ceiling. I think that's all garbage.
Right.
You know, that's like saying, oh, I didn't vote for the Iraq War. I just voted to give Bush the authority to do it. It's completely different. No, it's not.
That's
you
right.
Vote for Obama to raise the authority, right? You're voting to raise the debt ceiling.
Right.
But on the other hand, at least it wouldn't raise taxes, and at least it wouldn't do anything else, you know, any other fake spending cuts or the rest of it. But then you had Reid come in and start adding in cuts, you know, asking for, you know, $1.5 trillion of cuts over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so that immediately raises my suspicion is, you know, what you talked about is I think Obama wants to have a big 10-year window, put in all the cuts at the back end of it,
yeah.
So that he can possibly even raise spending at the front part of it.
Yeah. I mean, and that is what he wants, exactly.
Right. I mean, this is a big opportunity for the Democrats to do the doc fix. I mean, this is a problem that is Obamacare related, and is something that they would otherwise have to deal with come January. Mm-hmm. That if they are able to somehow, you know, say, oh, we'll cut, you know, $800 billion from Medicare, you know, 8-9 years from now, but and then they're able to use that those savings to pay for the doc fix for the next 5 years. That'd be a huge win for the Democrats and an absolute nightmare for the Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you're looking on politics, again, I get very confused talking about the politics of this. In terms of policy, I think that Republicans have a lot to be happy about here. The White House has put all sorts of options that are normally loathed to Democrats on the table. They've talked about raising the Social Security eligibility age, for instance. They've talked about really deep cuts to Medicaid. They've talked about all sorts of different things that normally would be utterly just anathema to them. And so I think that both sides here, you know, I think that if you're looking at policy concessions, I think that the Republicans are coming out ahead. But in terms of politics, I do think that the Democrats have played this fairly well. They are trying, and I think succeeding, at making the Republicans look somewhat ridiculous. Like, they just won't say yes to anything, and that there's all these options and that they just can't get anything through. And I think that, you know, I'm looking forward to the sort of 5,000 or 4,000 word piece explaining John Boehner's role in all of this, because I think he's, you know, become the most interesting man in politics here, and especially the Boehner-Cantor relationship. And it's, yeah, I do think that we're in the end game, though, and I do think that we'll see something in the next couple of days, and in part just because they have to. I think one thing that's absolutely true is that they're both now, both sides are entirely committed to getting this raise sooner rather than later, you know, because the bond market has been very accommodating up until now, but, you know, I think at some point this really will start scaring people.
The only thing I'm hopeful of is that after taking this cut, cap, and balance vote, after those more conservative House members are able to say, you know, look, we voted for a balanced budget amendment, we fought, that they're at least able to come off the sidelines and actually try to shape what the final compromise looks like.
Sure.
Because right now it's looking a lot like just Harry Reid and a bunch of Democrats throwing in a bunch of pork to the McConnell plan that probably could easily pass the House on mostly Democratic votes and just getting a couple Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the Republicans want to have a deal that is on their side at all, they're really going to have to, and they should have been a long time ago, coming to the table with something new. And I mean, it's not like, you know, they haven't voted for the spending before.
Right.
I mean, they voted for the Ryan budget, which, you know, which, you know, as Chuck Schumer pointed out, you know, requires a higher debt limit, you know, up through 2021.
Right.
So they've already voted for spending on this level.
Right.
So they should have had come to the table on the debt limit with a better ask, maybe stuff from the Ryan budget. But they didn't. Instead, they came up with all these spending caps and balanced budget amendment, which, you know, would have required a complete rewrite of the Ryan budget they already voted for.
Right.
So it was just completely incoherent.
Yeah, it was incoherent. And what do you think happened that it ended up this way? Because it does seem to me that Republicans essentially instigated this very long process. I think that both sides have really wanted to hammer this out, and there's been a lot of refusal to meet on in certain policy grounds. But why was it that they came in without those ideas and seemingly somewhat without a game plan? Do you think that it was, because my understanding, and I think
I think your storyline is wrong there. I mean, we talked about this before.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans didn't instigate this. This was instigated by the Democrats, who purposefully did not raise the debt ceiling in December. You know, we talked about that Brian Buell interview with Harry Reid before.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, they wanted Republican buy-in on the debt. Their plan from the beginning was to use the debt limit as a wedge between the new Tea Party conservatives and the more established John Boehner House establishment. And it wasn't working for a while. They were standing firm, but as we get down to the wire here, look at the wedge between Mitch McConnell and his conservative base.
It's
huge. They,
yeah.
You know, you got Eric Erickson calling him Pontius Pilate and a traitor. It's ended up working as the Democrats had intended to.
Yeah. So I guess in that sense, yeah, the process has, and again, it seems like the politics, which continue to somewhat mystify me, have perhaps worked out better for Democrats here. Although I remain just somewhat like disgusted with both sides and hope that they just pass something as soon as possible. But it does, you know, the bills that they're talking about are really big and the substance matters on them. So I do wish that we had, you know, if it is the Gang of Six plan that they're going forward with and they're tinkering with, I do wish that we had a lot more details because, you know, I think it was a
five page. I think the Gang of Six plan is as big a sideshow as the cut, cap and balance
mm-hmm.
vote. I think the real game is going on between Reid and McConnell, and it just worries me that we haven't seen any actual details out of them either.
Right. Yeah, that is true. And it is, you know, I do think that for a really long time it seemed like the ticking clock, which is, you know, part of the reason that this has become such a political football on both sides, is this sense that, you know, they have to do something sooner rather than later. You know, I think the fact that we're kind of finally abutting the point at which, you know, they really do just actually have to do something, or otherwise they're going to put Treasury in a really terrible position. As we get closer to that, you know, that's why I do think that we'll start to see more details about this in the next couple of days. But yeah, it's been a very, very long process.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to go past next week. I think it's going to go right up to the second.
Yeah,
I can get anything done.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that it's, you know, again, from a political point of view, it makes sense to continue negotiating until you can't negotiate anymore on this. But yeah, we'll start to see.
Or as Obama might say, until someone calls your bluff.
Yeah, I guess that's right. So another topic that we were meant to delve into a little bit today is not this Congress, but possible Congresses and administrations of the future, which is the Republican primary, in which we've had sort of a fairly big news week here.
Oh, maybe a little bit. I mean, there was I don't know how big this Daily Caller story is going to be about Michelle Bachmann. It hasn't gotten. I didn't see it get a ton of pickup today. I've seen people mostly dismiss it. For those of you that haven't seen it, it basically accuses her of having migraines at very stressful times that she uses lots of pills to deal with. And, you know, there's been some talk at the corner and other places about how this is, a serious charge to her competence to be president if she basically goes non-functional in stressful times. Mm-hmm. But I've seen a lot of other people dismiss it too, and I also don't think I've seen any reaction from Team Bachmann yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I saw something come across the transom that they had responded and said that she did, in fact, use pain management medication, as prescribed by her doctors and advised by her doctors to handle her migraines. But I think that they were fairly dismissive of it also. You know, and I guess the kudos to the Daily Caller for getting the scoop on the story. But it doesn't seem to me to be, I think a lot of people have migraines, and certainly migraine sufferers, I think, have thought that the story was somewhat sensationalized. I don't think that it seems like people care very much about this. For better or worse, it doesn't seem to have changed very much.
No, not yet. I mean, I think you'd really have to see another campaign pick it up for it to get any legs. Right now, it's just on, a Daily Caller site that I don't think you're going to have primary voters in Iowa necessarily reading.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And at least to me, it seemed like, I think that the press reaction was somewhat, I think that people described the story as somewhat unfair and maybe one-sided. I actually didn't feel that way. It seemed,
You thought the headline fit the actual facts that they had below?
No, I mean, I thought that the headline was somewhat misleading and that it was somewhat sensationalized. But, obviously I think it would be good to get Bachmann response in the story and to perhaps name people who were talking about this. But again, it didn't strike me as being such a big deal. I'm by now somewhat accustomed to rolling my eyes at the Daily Caller, so it's better than some headlining that I've seen them do.
Well, while we're talking about Michelle Bachmann, I would just like to clear one thing up. I did a post last week after Michelle Bachmann did an interview where she said she wouldn't sign, she wouldn't vote for a debt limit increase unless repealing Obamacare was on the table. Mm-hmm. And so I just did a quick post that said, Michelle Bachmann's right, repealing Obamacare should be on the table in the debt limit, mm-hmm. and tweeted it out. And ever since then, every lefty in the world thinks I'm like Michelle Bachmann's official tweeter. I'm getting all kinds of response. Every time she tweets something out and they respond to her, I get included on it. Mm-hmm. So I'm in no way affiliated with Michelle Bachmann. She's not my favorite congressman in the world, let alone my GOP candidate. So you can all just stop including me on those Bachmann tweets. Uh-huh. I get it.
But wait, why? Wait, this is interesting. Why tie the two things together, except for the fact that you want both of them to happen?
Oh, why should it be on the table? Well, Obama's the one that says everything should be on the table. I mean, if we're talking about the Bush tax cuts, sure. His signature domestic accomplishment being on the table, uh-huh. I don't see why Obamacare shouldn't be. I mean, look at the Gang of Six. Kent Conrad put the repeal of the Class Act in there. That's Obamacare right there. Uh-huh. So I'm not the only one putting Obamacare on the table here.
Yeah, no, and certainly I understand why from Michelle Bachmann's and your perspective, you would love to have the repeal of Obamacare there. But it's kind of funny. It seems like some of the energy to do that has sort of fizzled out of late, right?
You mean just repeal in general? Yeah. Well, I think, they had a bunch of, they actually did repeal the IRS reporting rules for all the business purchases under, what was it, over $1,000 or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. So they actually repealed that, and there have been some other measures. But, no, I think, you're definitely going to wait until after the 2012 elections before you have more movement on that front.
Sure. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. And so what else is going on in GOP primary land? I'm trying to remember.
Well, you just have Tim Pawlenty just fading off of the face of the earth.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. It's been, it's I don't know very much about how his campaign has been run or something else, but it does seem like it's just been like a lack of charisma, and that other candidates have just had a lot more momentum in their campaigns than him. So what do you chalk it up to, the fact that he's just kind of disappeared?
I don't think he went in there with an audience to sell. He had no real constituency that he said, you know, these are my people. He's trying to be,
right.
I mean, you know, from the beginning, if you look at the profiles in like National Review and Weekly Standard,
yeah.
They're all pretty much the same thing, is like, he's the acceptable candidate. He's the, you know, all things to everybody guy.
Right.
Well, we're not at that point where people are looking at that. People are looking for, you know, who is going to give them voice. I think that's why, you know, Michelle Bachmann's so powerful. In the campaign so far, is that you have a constituency within the Republican Party that mm-hmm. wants to see her succeed, maybe not get the nomination eventually, but at least succeed early on so that she can give voice to their causes and to their issues.
Mm-hmm.
So she's getting lots of attention and money. You know, so is other, you know, like Herman Cain has been doing fairly well. You know, Ron Paul, of course, has a built-in strong constituency that, you know, was never going to win the primary, and he's never going to be the nominee. But there's a built-in universe of people that have money and are fans of his that will keep him alive.
Right.
And there's just no constituency for Polanco. At least he hasn't found one yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And what do you make of Perry's coming into the race or being called to run?
Right. He had the interview this weekend where he said he increasingly mm-hmm. feels like he's being called to run.
Right.
Yeah, I think he definitely eats into Bachmann's
sure.
profile. You know, kind of evangelical, but also more Federalist Tea Party people. You know, his book that the book tour for was all about, you know, mm-hmm. kind of federalism, 10th Amendment stuff.
Right.
So it's, you know, knee deep in Tea Party rhetoric. So it's definitely would cut into Michelle Bachmann's primary profile voter that she's going after. So I think it would make life harder for her.
Yeah.
But I think eventually Palin's going to announce she's not running, which will help, you know, the Bachmann Perry camp.
Yeah.
All that's good news for Romney. It's just more distraction from him being the front runner.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that, you know, I think this is something that we talked about in our last blogging heads that got sort of undercut. I do think that Perry might cut into Bachmann's to Bachmann's constituency here, but she has just been fantastically impressive, I think. She's gotten very good on the substance. I think that she has become much better at debating, at public speaking, obviously. I think that her campaign and her campaigning is going a lot better than I would have thought. So I think that she'll remain somewhat strong. And actually, I know was witness to a bet between two very strong Democrats, one of whom is now convinced that she's going to win Iowa and that she's going to be, you know, that when it comes down to it, it's just going to be Romney and her.
I could totally see her winning Iowa.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely mm-hmm. within the realm of possibilities.
I don't know at this point, but I have just been impressed by the strength and the seriousness of the Bachmann campaign and how quickly she, I think, has become like a person who seems to speak very fluidly on national issues.
Well, I don't think a lot of people out of politics realize how much of a learned skill it is.
Yeah,
it is. You know, some people do have just natural talents like Bill Clinton, but for a lot of politicians,
right.
you know, they had a skill set, whatever it was, academia, business, whatever, and then they just learned politician being, you know, glad handing, making speeches. It's a skill like riding a bike, like anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that the big thing that Bachmann did that I just don't think that Palin got around to doing for whatever reason, I don't think that Palin sort of like studied up on that in the same way that Bachmann did. And
she didn't have the time. She didn't have the time.
She
went from 0 to 60. She went from, you know, college ball to the pros. She didn't,
right.
she didn't get to spend any time in AA, AAA, single A, any of that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah. Whereas Bachmann, I think it's been a very sort of studied campaign. And so, is that an official Con Carroll? If you had to bet, do you think that she's going to take Iowa? And do you think that Romney is going to be the eventual winner here?
If I had to bet today, and I don't want to, but if I had
and
to,
and not as an
yes.
endorsement,
yes,
yeah,
I would, I would take Bachmann in Iowa and Romney for the for the whole thing.
Yeah, I don't know about Bachman in Iowa. I definitely think that it's going to be Romney. And, you know, I think if you had asked me 6 months ago, I would have said that I thought it was going to be Paul Lundy. But obviously, you know, I would have been very, very wrong about that.
He's just getting no traction. He's poured money and resources into Iowa, and it's just not showing up in the polls or anything.
Yeah, and yeah. Pretty sure it's going to be Obama on the Democratic side.
It's a safe bet.
Yeah, I think he has some built-in support there.
Okay, I just wanted to plug just a couple of studies from the Kauffman Foundation here.
Yeah, let's do this.
Actually, one is a study, one is a kind of more legislative proposal. Mm-hmm. And they're linked. Mm-hmm. So the first one is the Starting Smaller, Staying Smaller, America's Slow Leak in Job Creation. Mm-hmm. And this is just goes through census data and BLS data going over the past, I think they go back 20 years or so, mm-hmm. and or longer, 40 years, I guess. And basically they show that if you look at each individual year of new business creation as its own cohort, it shows that over time, small businesses are starting smaller, which means they're not hiring as many people in their first year. So instead of having a business of, let's say, 10 people, there'd be a business of only 5 people. Mm-hmm. And then they're not hiring people as fast, and not as many of them are surviving.
Right.
And so basically the study shows that much of the lack of employment growth that you're seeing in this recession is from this, as they describe it, kind of a slow leak from new firm job creation. And this was something that was not evident during the last recovery, which was, you know, 2001, 2002, but
right.
started showing up before the economy collapsed in about 2006, 2007.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating piece of research. And I think that, you know, I personally am fairly agnostic on where jobs come from. You know, I think that there's been previous good Kauffman research showing that it tends to be young companies that generate jobs over time, and that what you need is a massive churn of new businesses because so many new businesses fail.
So you're agnostic in that you don't care or you don't know?
No, I'm agnostic in the sense that, like, if it were that right now the only people creating jobs were big businesses, I would think that would be an absolutely fine thing.
Okay, so it's that you don't care.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Okay.
I think that especially now, I think that, you know, during periods of much stronger growth, you hope that the economy is generating new businesses, just, you know, for all sorts of reasons about economic dynamism. But right now, you know, I think that... you know, we'll take them wherever we can get them, basically. But the thing that's so worrying about this, and I don't know the answer, is you know, and I know that Kauffman goes into this a little bit, it's just how do you solve this problem, right? How do you tackle this? If you now know that this is a contributing factor at the very least, what is it that you can do to help these businesses get along? You can improve credit conditions. You can obviously, you know.
Well, Annie, I'm glad you asked, because they then come out with their own Startup Act.
Right.
Which... I think there's maybe two or three things in here I like.
Yeah.
And there's 10 items. I mean, there's two of them I think you're a fan of, which would be the entrepreneur's visas.
Yeah, that's the one.
Big fan of those.
And the green cards for diplomas of STEM degrees.
Yep.
That's basically, you know, science stuff. Mm-hmm. Which I know you've written on before.
Yeah, I have.
But there's also... where they have differentiated patent fees, which is something I like, which I think would basically you'd allow anybody to, just like when you buy airline tickets, you can pay less or more for a better seat or anything else. You could pay the patent office more money to get to bump your application further in line.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, they would force universities to allow professors to license their technologies they see fit, instead of having them go through the university. Basically, each university these days has their own patent office, so basically just free university professors to license their technology clicker. I think that'd be great. But I think a lot of the other stuff that's in here, except for the assessment of local policies, but a lot of the other stuff that's in here just seems to be more loopholes and you know, kind of special breaks and revisions that complicates a legislative framework that is already just too complicated.
Sure. I mean, so running back to this piece that I had written a while ago, and this is something that I just believe, the United States actually doesn't have that many visas for people who are coming and starting businesses. It tends to kick people out after 2 years, when sometimes it can take longer for these companies to get on their feet. It seems to me that it's just, it's a cheap, easy, free thing to do to let a lot more entrepreneurs in, and then to take folks with STEM degrees and just to let them stay. You know, and there's all sorts of studies showing that these people tend to create a lot of jobs, tend to create a lot of businesses, and studies both in Silicon Valley and in California and nationally. So I think that those are just, you know, they're kind of freebies. And I think the problem is to get those kind of changes out of broader immigration reform has proven impossible.
Right. I mean these are all changes that you could find, you know, positively spoken about in the Heritage immigration piece.
Yeah.
Any Heritage immigration paper.
And it's just such an obvious thing, and I think that there's real bipartisan support for it, actually. But when you talk to folks on the Hill, and this is something that, you know, rankles me, even I kind of understand the logic here, you know, they just won't decouple it from immigration reform, because those are the parts that...
Well, when you say they, who do you mean?
People on the Hill, basically, on both sides.
I would say it's more squarely on the Democrats who want to push for amnesty, but I guess the Lindsey Grahams of the world and the John McCains also might not want to decouple it.
Sure, but
if you were to go to the Eric Cantors and the Paul Ryans and the Republican study committees of the world, they'd be totally fine with decoupling them.
Yeah, I think that that's right, and yes, certainly, I think Democrats, in terms of political logic, have more reason to keep those things coupled together and to refuse to do those separately. But it was, I mean, you know, this Startup Act has come through Congress a bunch of times. I'm pretty sure that it was John Kerry who put it up this year again. And it is. It's just a really, really good idea. But, you know, going back to kind of what I was saying before, I think that the things that you need to make these businesses succeed and to sort of generate more new businesses and more jobs is just a healthier economy more generally. And you know, that's the place that we're stuck in, right, is that if there isn't a lot of demand in the economy, if venture capital firms are being somewhat careful and, you know, there just isn't a lot of money sloshing around generally and people think that they're going to get better returns overseas, it's going to be a hard climate for startups more generally. And that's one piece that I think, you know, is important to recognize. The best thing that you can do for small businesses and startups and young businesses is have a really vibrant economy to begin with. And that's like the hardest thing to do.
Right.
You know?
But I mean, as the Kaufman study, you know, well, of course, and as a Keynesian, you'd of course believe along those lines. But, you know, as the Kaufman study showed, you know, this problem with the small businesses, you know, kind of began a couple years before the economy tanked, when
sure.
the economy was going pretty good in 05 and 06 and 07.
Sure.
And my theory is that it's not any one law, but it's just an accumulation of laws and regulations that new businesses have to master, learn, and understand in order to survive.
Sure.
I mean, if you're a small business owner or a new business owner who has a great idea for a pizza restaurant, you have a really great pizza recipe, you know how to do the lighting, the food, everything else, but you have to know so much more about unemployment concerns. You have to know about healthcare. You have to know about, FICA. You have to know about local ordinances. And then, you know, the bigger you get, this would be after you've had a bunch of pizza chains, you have to start worrying about Sarbanes-Oxley. You have to start worrying about all these other financial regulations. Mm-hmm. And there's just such a maze and soup of laws and regulations that, you know, didn't exist 15, 20 years ago. It's a slow accumulation of them that just forces entrepreneurs to have to pay more attention to stuff that's not what they do. That's not what they're specializing in. I mean, the whole idea of the firm is that you're specializing in something that you're good at, mm-hmm. whether it's, Google searches or web videos or whatever else, and that you don't have to learn everything. But, you know, all these regulations force these entrepreneurs to know all these laws that, you know, entrepreneurs past didn't have to know before.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've made a beautiful case for single payer, I think.
Which is totally my plan.
Yeah, no, exactly. I knew that was where this whole conversation was heading this whole time. But, no, I mean, look, I would complicate. I would say that the economy of the 2000s was not as vibrant as it might have looked.
Yes.
But it does get complicated, and I do think that you're right that from a small business standpoint, yes, of course regulations are bad, they're terrible, they're absolutely awful, and that, you know, any sort of thicket of paperwork that you have to jump through, is frustrating, especially on a very local level. It's funny because I'm getting married, and so to get married in the District of Columbia, you have to fill out a single piece of paper at minimum. So, you know, if you want to do it in a church and go someplace else or whatever, you have to fill out 3 or 4. But at minimum, there's one piece of paper. And to start a business in the District of Columbia, there's like 8.
Oh, and I was like that one piece of paper actually sounds kind of simple.
No, exactly. And, you know, this is just there's however many examples of how difficult it is to to start businesses, and I understand that you have to register and you have to, you know, file, set yourself up to do taxes and whatever else. It's actually more complicated, but yeah, you know, I do think that the overall trend is worrying, and I do think that the Kauffman Report is a really good piece of research for anybody who's interested in this. Should go check it out, and they generally I think that they do really great work.
They do. If I could just talk about one more thing in here, which
yeah,
I like the idea of it, but. I didn't like the way they implemented it. You know, they talk about they're very excited about this doing business report that I think the IMF puts out,
mm-hmm.
and just it's a measure of for foreign countries of how easy it is to open a business, licenses, days to get licenses, you know, who you have to bribe, etc. And that has forced a lot of countries to pay attention and start, you know, reforming how they do that so they can improve their standing on these rankings.
Yeah.
And so the Kauffman Foundation wants the Commerce Department to do something similar. And so, you know, I like the idea of the rankings. I like the idea of, you know, going through having the states, you know, competing for the best business environment. But, you know, why can't this be done by a nonprofit? Why can't this be done by a private organization? Like, for example, the Kauffman Foundation. Why does it have to be a government entity like the Commerce Department?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I would be happy to see anybody do it. Because it is true. And actually, at this panel that I was at this morning, that Chris Koons was at, that I mentioned before, it was with a bunch of folks who invest in clean energy. And they were pointing out that working in the United States in terms of energy regulations, and obviously a very heavily regulated sector of the economy, it's like dealing with 50 countries. And so the comparison was with China, where obviously, you know, you have to work with regional governments and the national government, but that it was much, 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 much simpler. And I think that, you know, making any sort of offhand comparison between the U.S. and China in political or economic terms is usually, you know, it's usually far more complicated than it sounds. But I do think that they were right that you have essentially sort of 50 economies when it comes to regulatory structures, and that's got to be, you know, that's hard.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think we both wanted to get out here early.
Yeah, we were gonna keep this. We were gonna not as short as our last one, but short.
There you go. I think we're just under 40. Sounds like a good place to end.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Con.
Always wonderful talking to you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.